It's a welcome return for David Michaud to our latest episode of Soundtracking, in which the Australian director talks us through the music of his latest film, The King. The King is available on Netflix now and is loosely based on William Shakespeare's play relating to Henry V. In putting the movie together, David turned to a couple of friends of the show, co-writer and actor Joe Edgerton and composer Nicholas Britell. Plenty more on both of those gentlemen shortly. First, a word from the good folk at Stitch Fix. Now, how do you fancy getting some help with your wardrobe? I know that I happily welcome some guidance. Now, I'm not the biggest fan of shopping. I always feel overwhelmed by the choice, and those changing rooms make me feel utterly self-conscious. So I was very happy to hear about Stitch Fix, an online personal styling service that can help you put outfits together from 100 of the best brands, including established names, cool emerging designers, as well as exclusive brands that you won't find anywhere else. And this is not just for the ladies, as the service is also brilliant for men too. It's really simple to use. You start by filling out a style quiz, which asks you about things like aesthetic, budget, size, shape, clothing needs and wants. One of the stylists will then handpick you 5 items. They arrive at your door so you can try them on, buy what you like, send back what you don't at no cost. You pay £10 for your stylist, but this is deducted from anything that you buy. There's no subscription and you can order regular deliveries or a one-off for a special event. Get started with Stitch Fix today and support our podcast by going to stitchfix.co.uk/sound right now. That's stitchfix.co.uk/sound. And so to David, the King and Nicholas's score, which has a quite intentionally otherworldly sensibility. We'll hear why in a moment after we get a taster of what otherworldly sounds like with this cue, Tetrachord Rex. David, welcome back to Soundtracking, first of all.
Thanks for having me. It's a joy to be back.
Episode 43 back in June 2017.
Yeah.
Yeah, and here we are with The King. I was just saying I had the absolute pleasure of watching it on an enormous screen with a fantastic sound system in Leicester Square yesterday. And it was glorious. Yeah. Absolutely glorious. Congratulations on the film. When we talked last time, one of the things that I loved hearing you talk about was about how music plays a part way before you've even shot the film, before you've even hired a composer. It's kind of part of your creation of the narrative, of the characters, of how you want it to look as well. Was that the case with The King as well?
Yeah. Yeah. I start building those playlists. I mean, and, you know, very often I feel like I'm building playlists that will form the basis of in some way or other the soundtrack, you know, and and this movie, something extraordinary happened in working with Nick Britell, you know, and that just all of those pieces of music that I thought were just so necessary just started to slip away, you know, and as more of Nick's music started finding its way into the movie, the more stuff, some of those necessary pieces became temp and started to feel wrong. And so there's not a single, Nick's music is wall to wall in this thing now.
What were some of the things, though, that you had originally seen as music or that were inspired in, well, on that kind of playlist? What kind of thing helped you along the way up to that point of getting Nick?
This movie being set in the Middle Ages, you know, I wanted it to feel otherworldly. certainly didn't want to fill it with medieval music. That would have hurt.
That would have made it Blackadder.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, I've also wanted to musically embrace that idea that I was finding permeated my conversations with every department, which was how almost impossible it is to conceive what life might have been like back in the Middle Ages. You know, when mm-hmm. you think about how differently people spoke and moved, thought,
yeah,
even just 50, 70 years ago, you know, you multiply that by 600 years. And I wanted the movie to feel strange. So, not ridiculously so, but just have a some kind of undercurrent of the unusual. And so all of my early temp music was all, I just used a lot of Celsi, classical instruments, but very often used very atonally and arrhythmically.
Yeah.
Difficult to pinpoint exactly when these pieces of music are from.
Yeah.
You know, they could be. They could be very old, or they could be from some distant future.
Yeah.
But I also knew that there was so much of this story that I knew could be very moving, mm-hmm. and so I needed music to do that work as well.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted on some level for it to have a big, rich and austere score.
Yeah.
And just find the places for it to have unusual instrumentations or just unusual sounds.
I love how it kind of, even the volume of the music plays an important part, I think. Up until a point, the music's, it's there, but it's very much in the background and almost kind of, almost like at the coronation is almost kind of, I feel, where you kind of, where it's, it shifts in a way in terms of it's playing a different part. I mean, I don't know what the, if that's right or if that's just me reading too much into it or if there's a purpose to that for you.
There was, we could feel it when we were, it's just, especially when we were mixing the film, you know, it was never, I don't think the music was composed to be mixed that way, but it felt like the right thing to do
yeah.
when we were mixing was to let it sit quietly behind the movie
yeah.
to begin with. And then you're right, at a certain point around the coronation, you know, when this kid's life turns upside down, it starts to sit on top. And then as you get down towards the back end, it actually almost starts to sit right up front.
Yeah. It's really powerful. It's like, but it's crazy how almost just the volume can do that.
Yeah.
But it does.
Yeah. I mean, it's what makes being in a final mix such a, I actually find it, I mean, it's so pleasurable because in almost every respect, the movie is done and now, and I'm listening to it in its most magnificent form. Mm. But it's nerve-wracking as well, because one little shift of a fader can radically alter the way a scene feels. You know, just where the music is sitting in relation to dialogue, or, you know, how much of it you have, how, you know, if it's scary, you know, because you have that one little shift on a fader and then it's done. Yeah. It's there forever.
What were the conversations you had with Nicholas about how you wanted him to work alongside this film and what you were looking for?
It was kind of tricky. Actually, I think, I don't think Nicholas would mind me saying this, but, you know, the process started out quite tricky. I don't think either of us had worked so remotely before. You know, I was in Sydney and he was in New York. And I like to get involved, and I knew at some point I'd probably make a trip to New York or he would come out to Sydney. But, you know, we start the process. For one reason or other, he started quite late. I mean, I've never had music come in so late. And, you know, we were still trying to feel it out. And this, you know, maybe it's been probably entirely my fault, but, you know, my inability to properly articulate what it was that I wanted. But that, what I now realize, was something that was actually quite rich and full. I think maybe I pushed the strangeness card too hard early on, you know, and Nick and I talked about the idea of this score, the music could sound like it might have been from the 25th century, you know. And I think we pushed some of that too hard early on. It sounded a little too sci-fi, a little too incongruous.
Yeah.
And so, it was quite a bit of muddling around us kind of, you know, remotely. It's so hard to do, you know, phone calls and emails, and it's not the way music works.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I got on a plane and came over to New York quite late in the post process and sat down with him for about 8 or 9 days that suddenly, you know, even the first few couple of days of that were us still trying to work out what language we were speaking.
That must be scary.
It is, because, you know, it's like music is everything, I think. Many a potentially otherwise great movie has been ruined by bad music, and many a mediocre movie has been greatly elevated by amazing music. And yeah, it's scary. And as we were there, you know, nutting it out, trying to work out how to find it, and then something happened on day three. And it was what emerged from that, you know, morning where we were just really wrestling over one particular cue was Hal's theme, you know, the most important piece of music in the... There are a number of themes that run through it, but Hal's one, big one that ends the movie, you know, and that appears in various incarnations throughout. it emerged out of that wrestle and something happened. Something clicked into a gear. And from that point on, without exception, we were speaking the same language and never wrestled over another thing from that point on.
Yeah.
And we both started wagging our tails like excited little kids. And so much music was composed in that week. I mean, the entire movie pretty much came out of this one week. I mean, this is a testament to Nick's skill. You know, he's like this. These are complex pieces of music, big, rich, layered, so many stems. He's so gifted, you know, so trained, so talented, and so enthusiastic. You know, that, I mean, he says he's never produced that much music in that short of time before. But yeah, it's kind of exhilarating. I remember getting back on the plane back to Sydney after it and dizzy. You know, I mean, we almost didn't have an opportunity to listen back to a lot of the stuff we'd done, but we knew that it was beautiful.
Yeah, it's a really different score for him than what I've heard him do before. And I mean that in a really positive way. And I like that hearing that story, because it feels like you know, kind of pushing each other is kind of has created this absolutely glorious thing that I haven't really heard him do yet. And there's some of the cues that I kind of noted down as well was the, when there's one for me that really, when they're crossing the channel, and oh my God, I love such a beautiful melody in that kind of piece, and how the music accompanies that journey as well. It's just it's stunning.
Yeah. Yeah, that was another one of the themes. That was the one that I think if it's the one, you know, there's the beach landing, which has got this huge kind of almost like a Gira Wrath of God sort of choir thing going on. Before that, there's that theme that we were calling Falstaff's theme, you know, Yeah, and I think a lot of what, you know, it's, in some ways, some of the things that we did with the early sketches, with Nick's early sketches, we actually just simplify them. They were almost, the early ones were almost too complex. And sometimes that complexity I find, and maybe this is just, you know, my musically naive brain, but the complexity can sometimes stand in the way of basic feeling.
Yeah. You know? Like the simplicity of that, I don't know if it's a cello, it sounds like a cello to me, with the brother and sister, just a little conversation mm-hmm. across the lawn. It's a really simplistic piece of music, but it lets you into their intimacy and relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
But still accompanies it as well.
Mm-hmm.
You have those two sort of sides of it, of that, and then the coronation, which is just gets bigger and louder and more regal.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, and you have that, you know, that feeling that you get when you, because like you say, it's scary.
Mm.
You know,
you
spent all this time, all these years writing and prepping and the money and the pain of the shoot and months of post-production, and that last layer is, you know, I've said it before, but it's everything. If that layer sucks, or if not even sucks, if that layer is disappointing to me in some way, then it's like I almost feel like I want to throw the whole thing out.
Yeah.
That's how important music is to me.
Yeah. I've been kind of thinking since I saw the film as well, like, oh, there's been a lot of how did you do that? The battle scenes in particular, you're kind of, you know, you're in there, and I mean, these are characters, you know, real characters that existed, but how you've written them is just brilliant. And if you don't mind, I'd really like to talk a little bit about you and Joe working together and how you write together, and if he wrote his part or if he wrote his part or if you wrote it together. Because, oh my God, we all want a mate like that. He's he's a joy to watch in that role. It's great.
And, yeah, and it was fun for us to write it for him because, you know, Joel's, I mean, I've known him for a long time. We live practically next door to each other in Sydney, and we spend a lot of time together, and he's fun. But you don't really get to, he doesn't get to be fun in movies very often.
Great accent, and I mean, everything about it is just.
Yeah, he's good at
it's
that.
It's really good.
And he's just a joy to work with. You know, he's a good man. And because he's also a director now, he knows what I'm going through, which is
helpful, I imagine.
And in a strange circular way, I think it's good for him to, you know, it's like, suffering is a form of self-obsession very often, you know, and it's for him to be looking out for me and see checking with me, see if I'm okay as a director, actually I think makes him feel happier, less self-obsessed, you know. Not that he is an actually self-obsessed person, but, you know, it's like, especially when you're an actor, you know, it can be, it's, what they do is so mysterious and it can lend itself to sometimes a kind of toxic introspection.
Mm-hmm.
It's healthy in life just to think about other people.
Yeah. How did you, why did you want to tell this story?
Well, I didn't. It appealed to Joel.
Powers of persuasion.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't take much. I mean, there's, you know, there's when he came to me one day and said, do you want to, how do you feel about, he'd had an extraordinary experience fresh out of drama school playing Hal on stage in Sydney in a much acclaimed performance. I didn't know him then, but, you know, people were talking about it. I think it was a profoundly seminal creative early career experience for him. And when he came to me, you know, my first thought was no, but I think that's because my first thought about anything is no, you know. So if it's going to involve me having to leave the house, then I'm not interested. You know? But then I, as seemingly like clockwork, then actually what starts to appeal to me is the strangeness of the proposition, you know, that it isn't the kind of movie I would have pictured for myself. And so I like being set parameters and... How would I work within those parameters? And, you know, when I thought about Henry V, I thought about a kind of middle-aged man who invades France and, you know, wins the war and then start reading, you know, start doing deep dive research and start, you know, the first thing you discover is that, well, he was actually in his early 20s when he became king. And that's extraordinary, you know, the burden of responsibility. And in our drift away from Shakespeare, which began very early on, we started to reconceive the story as one about, you know, a young, well-intentioned, but possibly naive man, you know, becoming king, taking this high office and then being consumed by the machine of power around him. To the extent that, you can take that idealist, that noble, well-intentioned man and start pushing him into tyranny, which is one of the things that excited me about casting Timmy Chalamet in it, you know, is that there is something so beautifully open and soulful and available about him. And I just loved the idea of seeing what his kind of tyranny might look like.
Yeah.
Do you feel a sense of achievement?
In what regard?
In any regard. Do you?
A new chapter of my life has begun. Already I can feel the weight of this crown I wear. I've been forced to rely upon the counsel of men whose loyalty I question every waking moment. I need men around me I can trust. Here because you are my friend.
King has no friends. King has only followers and foe. But I will come with you.
All hail King Henry!
It's a beautiful performance. Did Timothy reach out to Joel for, you know, because he had that history with the character and playing him? And I imagine maybe a similar age to Timothy, I don't know. Maybe,
yeah, it would have been.
Is that, do you know if that's something they sort of talked about at all in terms of...
I actually don't know whether or not Timmy sought Joel out for Hal conversation.
Yeah.
I think Timmy just sought Joel out so that they could hang out, you know, as their characters do.
Yeah.
You know, Joel was... finishing, he was cutting Boy Erased in New York, and Timmy lives in New York, and they just hung out, got drunk together, and which is important. All of that stuff, it sounds kind of, anything you can do that just lubricates the social experience is useful.
How did you lubricate the experience of going in to film that battle then? Because I have no idea how you prepare for something like that, or you actually are able to achieve that. It's amazing with all the mud and I'm thinking in my head, God, that armor's really shiny, and then obviously it's getting dirty. That's like one, you know, how many takes are they going to, you know, someone's got to polish all that stuff back up. And
that's a fire hose.
It's the weird.
I mean, it really is.
Really?
Yeah.
Stand over there and let me fire hose you.
At the end of every day, it would just be, they'd line up and stand in the fire hose. And,
my God.
And they loved it because it was like, 35 degrees.
Where did you shoot it?
In a town called Szilvasvárad, which is 3 hours out of Budapest in Hungary.
Wow.
Mm.
Wow, was that hot, bloody hell.
Yeah, it was kind of horrible. It was horrible. And you have to, we prepped the hell out of it for months in advance and knew we needed to. We didn't have the luxury of just like figuring it out as we went along. We'd shot the whole, that whole battle in 2 weeks and we needed to prepare. But then with all that mud and all that stuff and all those, just the chaos of it, the plans always fall apart almost immediately. But at least they're there. At least you know what to return to when you're confused, which is all the time.
You cut none of it's amazing when we watch these finished creations on this big screen, and it's just, I'm just fascinated to get a sense of the chaos behind the camera that goes into making this beautiful kind of perfect thing that we all get to sit back and just allow us, entertain us. It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's the biggest sigh in the world.
I mean, it was, sometimes I feel, am I just bunging this on? Is it just shtick? Or it was, no, but I know, I remember it vividly. It was, there are certain things that, I'm incredibly lucky to have this job, and I'm so lucky that I get up in the morning and for the most part, it feels like a kind of play. But there are certain parts of it that are just hard, like really, really, it's not good for the health, it's, you worry, you've got all this money and all this prep and it's dangerous, and you've got people wearing all that stuff and sliding around in the mud, swinging swords at each other and everything. It's dangerous. And it was so stressful. I remember driving away from that location when we finally finished with this extraordinary, almost ecstatic sense of relief, that it was over. And I hoped that we'd gotten what we needed, but another part of me was just like, I don't care. I'll figure it out later. I just want to get out of here.
Just get me out here. Don't want to see another piece of armor like for the next 10 years. Were there any other films or soundtracks that were as part of an inspiration for you going into this?
Strangely, no. It might have been, I'm sure I probably would have said this to you last time we spoke, but it's like I very rarely, if ever, use scores from other movies when I'm temping. Maybe I should start. I don't know, because this one was really difficult to temp.
Well, there's so many cliches that you could have around it. It's the danger, isn't it, of something when it's kind of period. And then the other way as well, in terms of you can go so far the other way that it's finding that middle ground that does what you were saying about the kind of slightly crazy stuff, but still has a point of not easy to find.
And usually I find it, I find it with my editor. Pete Shibaris, we find it.
Yeah.
This one was really, the temp never found its shape. We were throwing around all sorts of, like John Luther Adams in there, but then also that beautiful, delicate sort of dreamy stuff, but then throwing in some kind of Penderecki bombast it always just sort of felt confused. It never found its shape in the temp. When Nick Britell watched the movie, it was with no score. There was no version of it that felt like an accurate representation of what I wanted him to do, which made scoring the movie scary, because it's like there was no clear template we were working from.
Yeah. Worth waiting for, though.
Yeah.
Totally.
Thank you.
what's next? Do you know?
No. No, I don't. I actually really, I quite like the feeling. Every movie thus far has felt like something that I've been working on for a long time, you know,
yeah.
even though they don't necessarily happen in order. They are things that have been brewing. And that also means that they think feel on some level like things from my past, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, so I quite like the feeling of knowing that whatever I do next will be very much of me today. Whatever that is.
I love the fact that last time we spoke for War Machine, obviously Nick and Warren did the score for you for that. And today we have a new Nick Cave record that's been released, which is a nice full circle.
I know.
I like that.
Warren came to the screening, to the premiere last night. I've been texting him all day. He's because he's, I you know, I love those guys.
Yeah.
And they were busy making the record when I was looking for someone to do the score. You know, and that's, I actually, and there is, it's the beautiful thing about this job. I get to, you know, I got to work with Nick Britell. I'm really happy about that. You form different relationships with different people. But I think, you know.
What did he say after the film last night?
I know that he loves it. I think he would tell me if he didn't. But yeah, he was on the train back to Brighton last night and like he said that you know, they kind of live streamed Ghostine on YouTube or something last night. And he said he was in a pizza shop when it started, you know. I think it was a very strange night for Warren last night.
Congratulations on this film again, David. It's really lovely to chat with you and catch up again. And yeah, it's epic and it's beautiful. And I'm going to go and see it again, actually. I can't wait to see it again. But thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me back, Eddie. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am beside you. I am beside you. I am beside you. I am beside you. Look for me. Look for me.
From Nick Cave's new album, Ghostine, that's Ghostine Speaks, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with the brilliant David Michaud. My huge thanks to David for taking the time to talk to us second time round. The King is available to stream on Netflix now with Nicholas's score available via our very good friends at Lakeshore Records. Now we'll put a Spotify playlist up for the show via edithbowman.com, which is also the place to subscribe to this podcast and catch up with all of our previous episodes, including David's last outing and my chats with Joel Edgerton and Nicholas Britell. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and please do check out our YouTube channel if you haven't already. Next up, very excited to welcome Anton Corbin to the podcast. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.